Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Shot Podcast. It is a great thrill as ever for us all to be with you. I'm Joe Dyer, and we have with us not Dave Milner. He's lost somewhere in the wilds of Melbourne, not joining us. We're not a priority. You're not a priority for him, dear listeners, today. But we do have in his stead Charles Firth.
Hello.
That's cute of you to say hello, Charles. And Grace Tame.
G'day.
And we're absolutely delighted to have once again joining us as our special guest contributor, Ronnie Salt.
Hello, good afternoon, good morning. I don't have Dave with me, I'm sorry. I have.
Do you think he's just out tasting craft beer? He said he'd got some important meeting to go to, but I kind of feel like his important meetings or his important the ESPY.
Yeah, what important meetings does Dave Milner have, let's be honest?
No, none.
But, we can quiz him on that next week. I want you to know that I got on a plane at 6:20 this morning in order that I could be back in Sydney to first attend the Julian Assange rally in Hyde Park and then hightail it so that I could be here with you. So no important meetings are more important to me than all of you. So there we go. This week we were, I think, celebrating at least commemorating in some way the first anniversary of the election of the Albanese Labor government and the sad farewell to the prime ministership of Scott Morrison, still hanging around in Parliament, of course, but no longer as our beloved leader. Ronnie, coming out of that first year, you had some sharp observations about Albo and his team, not enough for it just not to be as bad as Morrison.
Yes, and it's interesting. Number of people didn't like it, but that's okay. I was amazed at the amount of people that actually agreed with the piece, came forward, and including long-term Labor supporters and people that you would have, you know, normally classified as rusted on. But I'm not quite sure exactly what it is about Anthony Albanese that seems to have sort of disappointed people. Is it him or is it the AALP, the Albanese Australian Labor Party? I'm not quite sure what it is. Can't put my finger on it.
Well, you know, I think it's probably a combination of those things. I think the thing is that because Morrison and his mob were just so awful, there was an alliance of progressives that formed across people holding a range of progressive views from, you know, the most conservative of them, presumably, like if you can even call the right wing of the Labor Party progressive. But if you take that as the kind of the end point of a spectrum, really right through to people who would never have considered themselves supporters of major parties at all, in other times probably want to bring down the whole political system. But we all banded together to get rid of Morrison. And I think there was that breaking of relief, you know, the new dawn that we all felt on May 22nd. But then I think probably the stratification of the progressive side of politics has reemerged. It was always there. It was just put over for the greater good of the demise of Morrison. And now it is true that if you say some things which are probably uncontroversial when it comes to the progressive political position, some of the rusted on Labor people do get kind of cross with you. They don't want to hear the criticism of their party and their leader.
It's almost as if you were riding in the saddle with them and all of a sudden you've changed horses or what have you. That's a really brilliant observation, Joe. I like the way you put that. You're right, that there was a sort of almost a homogenous mass of us, working towards getting rid of the Conservative government. And then once we had seen the back of Scott Morrison, we all sort of then reassumed our positions. Yes, yes. I love the way you put that, yeah.
Mm,
no one left behind and no one held back.
Yeah. Sort of it's a testament to our sort of very polarized culture that's reinforced by the sort of tabloidified, mainstream media that detests nuance and can only see things in terms of, I guess, sort of Stan Grant put it, you know, battle lines as opposed to bridges. And, you know, it's like I often say, you know, many things and many opposing things can be true at once. You can be grateful for the dramatic shift, but also like healthily critique things. And we seem to have lost our ability to have just these healthy debates that don't descend into just throwing mud. And it almost scares people into these, really, really divided, places, and then they become like echo chambers where people only just want to hear things that validate their precise opinions as opposed to hear things that might challenge their worldview.
And I think that actually plays into the hands of the Labor Party at the moment. Like, there is a sort of polarization around things like climate and housing, where the Labor Party almost can get away with murder. We can get away with sort of
not murder.
Well, not murder, but they can get away with opening up coal mines and you know, approving half of the 119 gas mines that they were going to do, and doing absolutely nothing about housing. And they can get away with all that because if you're not with them, you're against them. You know, the polarization that you're talking about, Grace, allows them to sort of take this sort of position that, well, I'm sorry, there isn't any nuance, it's our way or the highway.
And that's the danger of being scared into silence, and that's what you sort of see. And when, you know, they talk about cancel culture, but really it's culture itself being cancelled. It's the nuance itself being cancelled by this polarisation where both sides are sort of doing effectively the same thing as each other, and, you know, because it's really just two opposite ends of the horseshoe that eventually meet and form a circle that just keep going round and round and round and round.
Which is an interesting observation, because if you look at the statistics from the last federal election, which was only 12 months ago, we have a more fragmented political landscape than ever before. I can't remember the exact statistic, but I think the ALP got their lowest primary vote than they had in sort of 30, 33 years or what have you. I'm sure
it did.
Someone very clever will come and correct me on that, but that's going from memory. And we have a lot of teals and independents and, small parties. Was it not Dai Li who recently announced that she was she was starting her own political party? You've got One Nation.
Frank Carbone, who served as deputy mayor. So that kind of elevated Carbone into the name of the co-name of the network, and most of us have never even heard of him.
A lovely little
politics being very vocal right there. Yeah.
And then you've got, we've got the one lone sausage there in the Senate for Clive Palmer.
Oh, yeah.
He's not even aware whether there is a United Australia Party or not.
Well, neither is he.
I was going to say I don't think he is either, and I'm not counting on him coming forward and realising it either. So, we've got a very fragmented sort of electorate, and so it's interesting to see this, either black or either white, when we've really got all these different shades of grey and, dare I say, teal as well.
Well, I think that's what the Labor Party and the government in particular are trying to ignore, because they have got that majority in the House of Reps. They're trying to ignore the full rainbow that exists alongside them and hope that they can solidify their majority in at the next election, which it's not clear that they will, given that they are seemingly disappointing so many people who went to them looking for genuine change. And I mean, in your article, Ronnie, you talk a little bit about the, well, you talk a lot about the mantra behind which they hide, that no one held back, no one left behind. And it's just repeated so often that the fact that it's not explained, you know, where this line is in front of which we should all be, if that mantra is to hold true, none of it is clear. It's just repeated again and again.
There's no, yeah, there's no benchmark. Like we've got to ask, like one of the things, you know, that we actually did in preparation for the state and territory budgets in the at the foundation was, you know, ask a series of questions in our own kind of behind the scenes review of the federal budget, which, you know, at the Commonwealth level, you know, there are some things that are done for child protection, but really because it's, you know, so it's such a nuanced thing and every state has, you know, like very different population distributions, especially when you think of like Tasmania, that's only half a million of us. and, you know, we all know each other. That's a joke.
Still get your 12 senators.
Yeah, thank you. But, you know, when it comes to the how populations are, you know, distributed in terms of like regional areas and all of those different factors, you know, different cultures and so on and so forth, child protection is an issue that is really governed by the states and territories, just like it is with legislation as well. And so what we did in preparation for the state and territory budgets is sort of ask a few questions about the distribution of funds, really in relation to the child's voice, because really when we're asking those questions or you know, those hearing those slogans about who's being left behind or not left behind and, you know, when we want to look at a benchmark, children are the ones that often get left behind. And especially when we think of like these umbrella terms of sexual abuse or domestic sexual and family violence that sort of bring all of these things together, the child's voice, the child's experience, boys and girls, do get forgotten because they just don't have equal power. And so we looked at these things and, you know, on paper there are what seem to be large sums of money for particular things. And yet we never actually know whether some services are being actually just given an amount of money that enables them to just function at crisis mode, or it enables them to lift beyond that point. And, you know, we sort of, yeah, we don't have a huge amount of detail. And so it is a really interesting kind of, well, not kind of, but vague thing to say when there are so many demographics that are definitely not equal to each other, and children are definitely at the forefront of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's the point. You can see that there are groups that are being left behind, and there are many, and we've talked about some of them already on this podcast. And there are many groups, as you say, Grace, who may be being left behind because we're not getting the information that we need. And you make that point too, Ronnie. Is anybody measuring who is being left behind? Is anybody tabulating the outcomes of policy investment? I mean, if we're not getting that information in any kind of clear form, and what we are getting is voices, you know, small voices holding up the hands and saying, well, I'm still living in a tent, or I'm still living in poverty, or I still can't get enough data on my mobile phone to enable me to look for a proper job while I'm subsisting beneath the poverty line on JobSeeker. So we're hearing these voices about people being left behind. We're hearing reassuring yet vague and empty mantras from the current Labor government. And it's not really surprising that we've still got lots of questions.
I think it's more important than ever in politics in the 21st century, where we govern by memes and make our decisions by, you know, by a sort of a 5-second scroll through Facebook or what have you. It's really important for people's political literacy, and I'm sorry to sound patronising, but it's true more than ever, that we actually dig down into the motherhood statements and the slogans and the positioning statements that they use, which is why, you know, early in my life I worked in advertising and communications and so on. That's why I dug down into that statement and said, well, you know, they have used this as a platform, as a mantra for the last 3 or 4 years. What actually does it mean? Because, you know, as I said in the article, when you dig down into it, it actually doesn't mean anything at all.
No.
It sounds nice, but, I mean, can you point me to the auditing of who's being left behind and who's not being held back?
And that's sort of the point, isn't it, though, Ronnie? Like, if you use a slogan that is impossible to find an answer to, then you know, that's sort of the magic, isn't it? That allows you to keep using it. And this is sort of how, you know, it's sort of really important to also, like, teach people to be able to understand. And this is what we're trying to do at the foundation, is not just focus on the events themselves of, like, child sexual abuse and stuff like that, but actually teach people, give them tools to understand what is being done to you, how are you being conditioned, give people the knowledge that is being withheld from them deliberately to be able to unpack things like marketing strategies, advertising techniques, because these are the things that are, like, permeating the mainstream, because there's very little difference now when we're talking about, you know, we're doing a podcast right now where we're surrounded by technology. It's Big Brother is ever present. It's the omnipotent, you know, omnipresent force that we are forced to rely on. You know, you go to the doctor's surgery and they ask you to check in on a tablet, you know, and we have to communicate via phones. So many things, even if we don't want to depend on technology, we actually have to depend on technology, big tech, and all of these things. And so the difference between our inner and outer worlds is constantly being eroded, and we sort of don't even understand that sort of compliance. And to give people the tools to sort of understand that and have as much power as they possibly can amid these conditions is really, really important. And to be able to question their sources, you know, is really important, because those are the things that sort of underpin grooming as well, is that sort of like coerced compliance while you're not even realizing it's happening to you. And there's sort of a reason.
I was going to say, it starts too, I think, with a lot of it starts with the front line. So it starts with journalists in presses, for example, who need to be there interpreting on behalf of, you know, the rest of the electorate or the population or so on. So, for example, when Scott Morrison lived off this phrase for a good 2 years, if you have a go, you get a go. What in God's name does that mean? What does it mean? You may as well be saying purple sausages. It's such a nonsense statement. It means nothing. It just fills the air. And yet I don't recall, and I'm happy to be corrected, I don't recall one journalist ever saying to Scott Morrison,
if you have a go at what, and you
what do you mean by that? You're telling the rest of Australia what it is. What does that mean?
I always thought it meant that if you went to a private boys' school, you got a go. If you had a go at that, then you got to go at everything else.
If you have to go to the toilet, you've got to go.
Which again, broken promise by Scott Morrison.
You have to go. Gotta go.
It was kind of funny.
He went to an academic boys' high school, Sydney Boys' High School. Mm. Now, I know that's different.
GPS. Yeah.
So that means that Sydney Boys' High, they were happy to claim John Howard, even though some of us might not have been so happy, but they did draw the line at wanting to celebrate Scott Morrison.
Just as a complete aside, I was looking at our social media stats for The Chaser this morning for completely other reasons. And the very depressing fact is that, and we've run plenty of anti-Labor Party, you know, headlines in the last 5 or 6 months. Like we're doing our job by, you know, satirizing those who are actually in power. Satire. Yes, but all our top performing headlines in the last 6 months have been jokes about Scott Morrison. Still,
he is the like,
he just keeps giving.
He is the as I called him the comedy self sourcing pudding.
Yes.
He is just like the gift.
The magic
the comedy
pudding.
The comedy yes. like pinata, as Robin Williams referred to George Bush. He just you know, candy falls from his
mind. I reckon
face.
Anthony Albanese is starting to have a touch of the Morrisons about his style. Like, I don't know whether you saw, but this morning he took a little selfie with some school kids and then tweeted out this nice little thing about you'd better get to school on time, right? And it was all trying to be heartwarming. But the selfie was not – he didn't post the selfie of him – it was a picture of him taking a selfie. You know what I mean? Like it was one step removed.
He does that though.
It's
like
so
the elbow,
weird.
The elbowception selfie.
Yeah.
The meta.
And he actually ran. Like one of the social media posts that they ran before the election was, you know, we're about policies, not about selfies.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
He certainly knew how to use me, that's for sure.
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, well, that's what he, like, the yeah, same so. Day that yeah. the same day that I, like, deliberately, like, what am I going to do next to Mr., you know, Hillsong and all his other myriad dubious things? And then,
is he talking about the great side eye day? That we should celebrate the anniversary of that.
Ooh, that was a while ago. That was in.
Where did you give?
Oh, sorry, I thought you were talking about Albo using. I must have misheard. Sorry.
Oh well, that was the same day. Albo, you know, I just stood next to him and I was like, I gave him a smile. Like these are things that happen in like very. I'd also met Scott Morrison. I'd met him before that as well, because the previous year. You know, they hold a Prime Minister's morning tea and Max and I had tried to speak to him about some things and he sort of hovered his – Max had to put himself as a buffer. Max is sort of built like a Berlin nightclub bouncer. And, he kind of had to put himself as a buffer because Scott Morrison, even though he's like – you know, he's quite enormous and I'm only 5'3" and I was trying to talk to him about some law reform ideas, and he just sort of like it was like his. You've seen the Wizard of Oz, and the Tin Man does this thing where he's like leans his body.
Yeah,
it wasn't
yeah.
quite as dramatic, but he just sort of like it was sort of
toes.
Like he wasn't on the level almost. He was like leaning his body a little bit forward, and he sort of had his hands behind his back from memory, and then I think he called somebody over who worked for him to give me a card. But he started talking about his father, who was
policeman.
A policeman, yes, and just saying, you know, sort of talking about that, which I thought, okay, that's fine. You know, it wasn't particularly, you know, I didn't feel any particular way about it other than he was quite imposing. He didn't, he was quite imposing anyway because, you know, at the time he was the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
And we all took photos. Everyone there took photos. This was before I was named Australian of the Year, and then also Max and I did take a, you know, true to our larrikin selves, we took a silly video, you know, about like we crept up behind him, and Max put some emojis in it, a floating coal lump of coal, and then there's some Hawaii emojis in it. But Max prior to that had been excited about meeting Scott Morrison because you know, Max is, I don't know, we were just two 26-year-old kids and he was excited to meet the Prime Minister because, I just wanted to meet the Prime Minister. But.
So, Charles, if you're the most engaged and like posts are jokes about Scott Morrison, what comes next? Is it then like jokes about Dutton? Do jokes about Albo make it into the top 10?
The Dutton one was... I think we've had three jokes about Scott Morrison, all of which are the like, top three. The fourth one was Dutton demands more detail on the coronation, which was a fairly standard joke, but I enjoyed. you literally have to get the one that we put out this morning, government to allow millennials to dip into super to buy milk bread, that'll end up performing very well. But, yeah, it's all – and, I mean, the Pauline Hanson one do well. Like, it's still just all the – you know, Pauline Hanson sells knitted white hoods to raise funds for lawsuits.
Pauline Hanson.
They always do well.
I made my first Pauline Hanson joke when I was all of 3 years old, by the way. My cousin Griffin and I are 3 days apart. He was born on Christmas Day, 1994, and I was born 3 days later. But Griffin and I were being looked after by my mother 1 year, we were three, and she was making dinner in the kitchen and we were just playing quietly in her periphery in an ensuite bathroom. And my mother, who had grown up quite poor, had a hangover from her childhood, and like my aunts are quite, all of them are quite similar. They have weird hangovers where they stockpile things. One of my aunts stockpiles like biscuits and things. Like her pantry's always full of like Arnott's like shapes and stuff like that. But my mum's hangover from childhood is toilet paper. She always has like heaps of toilet paper. She's always really worried that they're going to run out of we're going to run out of toilet paper.
She would have hated the pandemic.
I know. But
It came true.
Busted. Mum is the one who ruined the pandemic. If he came to my house at any point during the pandemic, no. Anyway, so Griffin and I were in the ensuite bathroom while Mum was making dinner when we were three. And we came across a stockpile of toilet paper and we were really quiet. So Mum didn't have any cause for concern. But what we were doing is we were unraveling every single roll of toilet paper. And we had made a sea of toilet paper around our little three-year-old ankles.
Oh my God.
And we were waiting in it and we'd filled up the shower cubicle and everything. And then when Mum came to get us for dinner, she saw us and I just apparently like totally deadpan looked at her and didn't miss a beat. And I just said, Pauline Hanson did it.
Oh my God.
And I mean, this was at the height of a lot of the controversies because the One Nation Party had just been established and it must have been something that it was on the news and Mum, you know, probably was one of those people who talked about it a lot. I don't know, but I just said Pauline Hanson did it.
It obviously had entered your brain that she was the villain who could be maligned and blamed for doing things that you were seeking to dodge blame for.
Yeah, worth a shot. I mean, we were in a sea of white, so.
Yeah.
I have to ask a question about the Pauline Hanson knitwear sale.
Yes.
Which I originally refused to believe was real.
I must say I refused to believe it was real either because, how much time does she have to spend knitting knitwear?
In fact, the whole thing confused me, but then again, we are talking about Pauline Hanson, so, you know, I won't go into it too deeply, but I couldn't quite work out, first of all, were these sort of little bits and pieces that she'd knitted herself while she was sort of in the Senate, you know, got a little bit of bag of wool and doing that, or was it a fundraising, for One Nation, was it for the Salvation Army, what was going on?
It is fundraising for One Nation, that much I had got, but what they were advertising was that these were actually hand-knitted by Pauline Hanson. So they're almost like a money can't buy kind of thing. But how many of them are there?
Was there evidence presented? I'm sorry to sound cynical. Is there any evidence presented as such?
That she had actually done them. Well, yes. This is the thing. It says that each one takes 60 hours or more.
Right.
And you're bidding on them, I believe. So it is presumably there'll be so many people who will have such desire to get their hands on these jumpers that they will, you know, force the price up of this sort of silent auction. It's to raise money for the defamation case that Maureen Faruqi has brought against her.
Oh, I see.
You have to place a bid to be able to see what the bidding is. And, of course, I'm not going to do that in the off chance that I ended up with one of them. So there's only four of them. So they are limited edition. If you wanted to,
okay.
It's a.
I'm looking at the website now. There's
a teal one. She's issued a teal one in honor of the independence.
Well, look. Yes, I probably better not say anything, but I won't be bidding on them.
No, there are different styles. They've each got a slightly different look to them, and then they're all in this sort of sea of teal to Napoleon blue to mauve to purple. Do you think that's feminist purple? Do you think Pauline is now kind of hammering her feminist?
So do you think
credentials?
Because they're kind of a nod to like traditional.
Traditional. Kind of, yeah. We used to have this ladies' wear shop in South Australia called Joyreen. Fabulous. Lovely for ladies. It was Joyreen.
Yes.
Lovely for ladies.
So they're emblematic of traditional values. And there's a subtext there that's being unspoken that is perhaps
that she is a traditional values kind of gal. So we've had 1 year of the Albanese government. Before we go, I do think there's a couple of things that we should acknowledge is that at the moment, or just this week, we have got the referendum enabling bills passing through Parliament. And so it is interesting that there is one thing on which Albanese has been courageous, and that is his commitment, steadfast, to take the voice to a referendum, despite the extraordinary unethical displays that we've been seeing from a wide array of people in supporting the no vote. And Crikey this week uncovered the fact that the Conservatives are doing a whole lot more of their little astroturfing tricks on Facebook and are actually using Lydia Thorpe's position on their funded websites and advertising for them, just to try and bolster a majority. So saying no, vote no, because it's not enough. But perhaps the worst transgression was where they went out and were saying, using a photo of Vincent Lingari's grandson and saying that he was opposed to The Voice, which was just completely, patently, blatantly untrue, and he's come out and said that himself, and there has been no retraction whatsoever. So,
as it turns out, sorry, Joe, it wasn't Vincent Lingari's grandson either.
The photo wasn't even of him.
No,
it was just a stock photo.
No, I think they're just making it the no side. Making it up as they go along, really.
And interesting,
they do, and yet being amplified again by the media, as if they have to show the no vote as lies and unethical behaviour as legitimate as the kind of 80% of certainly Indigenous peoples who are in support of the yes vote, and at the moment the sort of 55 to 60% of the Australian population is.
And this is one of the media tactics that is rarely spoken about, and yet, you know, ironically, we see it all the time. Well, not ironically, coincidentally, we see it all the time, is literally just proliferation, you know.
Yeah.
It's just constantly soaking. Yeah, exactly. Flooding the scene with shit. Constantly soaking people's, not just conscious minds, but and eventually it will seep into the subconscious. some of it will sift, some of it will filter through, and people will start asking, like, you know, if I, like, I don't go on Twitter anymore, you know, because even though I know that I could probably alter some of the controls and things like that, like I've done on Instagram, but you know, because I work in a high stress environment, I guess it makes me more susceptible to little small things. But you know, if it's just like, eventually something's gonna hit the sides, and yep. you, it's the butterfly effect of that, like that sort of mathematical, you know, thing, that eventually something will happen, and then you know that will then, much like a domino line, will potentially hit something else and so on and so forth. And it's remarkable to see, because clearly it's an operation, you know, it's an orchestra that's being conducted from multiple different, from several different ends.
And it, as Steve Bannon, who sort of came up with the strategy for Trump, the soak them in shit strategy, part of the brilliance of it is that it's about a lack of accountability, because how can you possibly fact check every single thing?
You can't, just wear them out.
Swamping of lies every day.
But it's not, I'm sorry, like Steve Bannon, hello, like just go back to Rupert Murdoch in when he owned this, well, he owned that newspaper in San Antonio, and like the headlines, the little headlines of that his paper in Texas were using were so out of character, and this was back in the 70s, early 70s, that one of the other local papers in San Antonio actually wrote an article back, like in response, to criticize it and make fun of it, because they were like, you know, midgets something something, you know, and like aliens fight over something something, you know. It was just obscene tabloid-esque nonsense. And so this other San Antonio paper said, you know, like weird, it was something like weird paper takes over Texas or something like that. And it just said, you know, like locals are learning things that they've never learned about before. And it's, you know, these stories, you can guarantee, feature a cast of repeating characters that are usually grannies, tots, and it's like, that's what, that like this stuff is not,
it's got a long history.
this is like you know, 40 some years ago, and it's also international, and you know, Rupert Murdoch did the same thing in the UK as well.
And actually, the SBS documentary series that's still going, about, it's coming out every week at the moment, about the Murdochs is worthy of watching, because of the very reminder of those sorts of early Murdoch tactics.
Like, yeah, I'm trying to find it. For some reason, I can't find it on my SBS On Demand, even though it must be there. So I'm going to put more effort into that, particularly with Succession's end looming.
It's brilliant. It's funded.
Large, all about Horizons next Monday.
It's funded by SBS, actually, and it features lots of Australian talking heads as well, which is quite fun. So you get to see Paul Barry explain various anecdotes. Richie Cook, who is now a monthly writer.
Paul Barry, of course, is very much an expert on the Murdochs, having written many books. Well, I shall find that because, as I say, we'll need something to remind us of how appalling the rich are once Succession finishes next week. And then finally, before we go, we will note the passing of the 93-year-old convicted pedophile Rolf Harris.
Yes, although actually I have to correct you on that, Joe, because now that he's dead, he's no longer a convicted pedophile. If you read the Herald this morning, he's actually a disgraced entertainer. Like he's been upgraded from, you know, convicted pedophile to disgraced entertainer.
He's
in a couple of weeks, he'll be a top bloke. So.
The sensationalist Morning
he'll be,
Herald.
Portraitist of the Queen kind of thing.
Oh, my goodness. The red scarers.
An interesting little side issue about Rolf Harris's death is that he actually died over 2 weeks ago.
What?
And he died. He died in the early hours of May 10th, and his family and friends. Well, I don't know who the friends are, but anyway, I'm sure that you know the people around him.
Still hanging on.
The people around him were so worried about what would happen at his funeral or any sort of subsequent incident that they kept the news quiet for 2 weeks. Just a little bit of trivia for you. To go, you know, that the shame followed him to the grave.
Too it bad.
I'm surprised that people are able to pull that off, actually. But even in this day and age with the media eyes everywhere, you can keep the death of a convicted pedophile meets disgraced entertainer meets portraitress to the Queen under wraps for a fortnight.
Who wrote that? Who wrote that article in the Sydney, excuse me, Sensationalist Morning?
God, take your pick.
Who was it? Seriously.
Never ask ChatGPT about Rolf Harris.
ChatGPT, ChatGPT can be tricked into producing child exploitation material in descriptive form. It can be tricked into doing it. It's so all these hand wringing cries from the tech sector about bow down to big tech. We need to have a 6-month pause on this this technology that you know generates some like AI. And what is AI, artificial intelligence? It's not artificial. It pulls stuff from the web.
Big tech should have time ago.
In the 1980s, military technology, which like that's what encryption software is. It's military technology was being used to transmit child sexual abuse material back then. And but now they're just going, we've had a sudden change of heart. Now we need to stop and
too late. You know,
yeah, well, it's just a bit obtuse, really.
We asked ChatGPT this morning whether it would shut itself down if it became a harm to humans, and it said no, it won't. So, so I think that
well,
horse
when
is
people
already
tell
bolded.
Who they are, believe them.
Yeah.
On that note. Thank you very much to all of you who've made it through to the end of this podcast for another week. Thank you very much to Ronnie for joining us this week. We look forward to getting your words in the next article and having you join us in the next podcast. And Charles, Grace and I will see you next week.
Bye.
Thank you.
See ya.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.